Today is Monday, August 26th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Coming up, will the United States and Iran meet to de-escalate tensions? That topic came up at the recent G7 summit.
We're reaching a point where the circumstances could be right.
Also ahead, several arrests were made in Hong Kong as protests continue in their 12th week, and what North Korea's latest missile test means for the prospects of talks and regional security. Those stories are all coming up next. Leaders at the Group of Seven meeting in France concluded their meetings on Monday during a joint news conference with U.S. President Donald Trump and French President Emmanuel Macron. The French president said that he had created the conditions for a possible meeting between Washington and Tehran. For more details, I spoke with reporter Catherine Field in Paris.
Yes, indeed, he did say that. He said we're reaching a point where the circumstances could be right, and he talked about the possibility of a meeting between the Iranian and the American president soon-ish. So essentially what it means is President Macron of France is building on the relations that he's been having behind the scenes with the Iranians over the last few months. And that, of course, came to fruition very visibly last Friday here in Paris when he met the Iranian foreign minister. And it was after that meeting that Emmanuel Macron thought, well, maybe I can go back to Donald Trump, I can go and talk to him, see if he's okay, and then if he's sort of okay with these initiatives, then the foreign minister can come to Biarritz, to the G7. Now, there was never any real talk that the foreign minister would meet with President Trump, but it was thought that this initiative was going along, and it also had backing from some of the other European partners. So that's where it's all come from. It does seem to be very positive. Everyone's putting a very positive spin on it at the moment. But, of course, the question is timing. The French president is keen it happens soon. Now, the next time that the two presidents would be together would be at the UN General Assembly in mid-September. Whether or not that's soon enough for the Americans and the Iranians to meet at that level is still a little bit doubtful, but certainly what we've seen is that the Europeans are still pushing ahead to make sure that this JCPOA agreement, this nuclear agreement that was signed with Iran, is upheld and it does live to see another day.
What else should our listeners know and take away as the G7 comes to a close?
I think the big issue, aside from Iran and possibly trade, where there was a lot of back and forth, the French president said that he wanted an end to this sort of tariff wars and a lot of the back and forth verbal abuse and an end to this threat of tariff. But I think the other point that is of interest has been that climate change played such a big role in this summit. There was a lot of talk about the Amazonian rainforest fires. There was agreement that there would be an emergency fund of some $20 million that would be made available to countries that are affected by these fires. Also, there was discussion on that. And that was very important for Emmanuel Macron because he has been pressing on this issue of climate change. And certainly on the last day, again, Emmanuel Macron, the French president, talked not just about the Amazonian rainforest fires, but also those fires that we're seeing in parts of Africa around the Great Lakes and Congo and around there. Although they're not rainforest fires, they are important. They're important for that region. So Emmanuel Macron brought that to the fore, even though he knew, in particular, when it came to the United States, he was going to have a tough job pushing that climate agenda.
Catherine Field is a Paris-based journalist covering the G7. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Steve.
In addition, French President Emmanuel Macron says that there will be a meeting next month on the Ukraine conflict with presidents of Russia, Ukraine, Germany, and France. Macron made the announcement as the G7 was coming to a close. He said it would be at the chief of state or government level, but gave no details. Macron said that the G7 leaders also could not agree on whether to invite Russia back into the grouping of leading democracies. Trade was also another major topic at the G7 summit. Now, before the meeting, U.S. President Donald Trump said he may invoke the International Emergency Economic Powers Act of 1977 and order U.S. companies not to do business with China. Gary Huffbauer is a non-resident senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics. He's a senior fellow there. I asked him to explain the act's intentions and powers.
Well, the International Emergency Economic Powers Act of 1977 was meant to update, modernize the very old Trading with the Enemy Act, which was passed in 1917, that is during the First World War. What the IEEPA Act, International Emergency Economic Powers Act, did was to say that during a national emergency declared by the president could then limit exports, imports, investment, portfolio flows, technology. In other words, he could prescribe restrictions on doing business with a foreign country or more than one foreign country. And that act has been the major statutory basis for the imposition of economic sanctions.
As this act was designed back in 1977, is there a sufficient emergency that would warrant its introduction to prevent U.S. companies to do trade with China?
Well, if you ask me, as an armchair, academic, I would say no, there's not a sufficient emergency. However, that's not how the process works. It's the courts who would say whether or not there's a sufficient emergency, and the courts have consistently said up to this time that if the president declares a national emergency, there's a national emergency. We're not going to second-guess the president. That's the president's decision.
What kind of implication would invoking this act have if it goes forward saying U.S. companies, you can't do business with China? What kind of implication, what kind of message does that send to the U.S. international trade partners that this could be a tool in the president's trade negotiations?
This would be just dramatic. This would be earth-shaking if he actually invoked the law as was threatened last week, because the law so far has been used in cases where, well, for example, Iran, Libya, obviously Cuba, obviously North Korea, these countries where we have clear differences, Venezuela, of policy and so forth, and countries which for the most part are not major trading partners. That includes as well Russia.
So if I understand you correctly, it's more about putting in place sanctions rather than preventing U.S. companies from trading.
Yes, it has been used as sanctions, with the goal of getting the foreign country to change its policy in some way, shape, or form.
Gary Huffbauer is a senior non-resident fellow with the Peterson Institute for International Economics. Thank you so much for your insight today.
Thank you for calling. Take care.
In other trade news, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development released data today that GDP growth slows to 0.5% in the second quarter of 2019. In other news around the world, the Democratic Republic of Congo has announced a coalition government 8 months after President Felix Tshisekedi won a long-delayed presidential election. Russia's state meteorological agency says it found several radioactive isotopes in samples it took following a recent accident at a northern military base during a weapons test. Three U.S. social media giants, Facebook, Twitter, and Google's YouTube, have taken action to remove hundreds of accounts with alleged ties to the Chinese government's manipulation of opinion about the anti-government movement in Hong Kong. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on the VOA mobile app. This is VOA News.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live, anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. voanews.com.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Hong Kong police said on Monday they made several arrests after violence during anti-government demonstrations escalated when protesters hurled Molotov cocktails at security forces who responded with water cannons and tear gas. Protesters say they are fighting the erosion of the One Country, Two Systems arrangement under which Hong Kong returned to China with the promise of continued freedoms not enjoyed on the mainland for 50 years. Hong Kong journalist Justin Solomon joins me with the latest. Hong Kong police have announced that they've made several arrests of protesters from this weekend's events. What can you tell us about who was arrested?
Well, this weekend we saw about 86 arrests the police have announced, and the youngest was aged 12 years old. These were protesters. Some of these people we are hearing were just residents that came out, and they may have been in the wrong place at the wrong time. When the police go in and make arrests, it's sort of anyone in their way could be a target for arrest. And that's what happened at the protests on both Saturday and Sunday this weekend in Hong Kong.
You mentioned that the youngest person reported being arrested is 12 years old. Do we know anything about the circumstances about that arrest?
Well, what police are saying is there was a raid in the Kowloon side of Hong Kong at one of the sites of the protests, and this 12-year-old boy was there. He was brought to a police station. His parents were brought right away afterwards, along with a lawyer. And the rest is a bit unclear, and it will probably shake out over the next few days.
You mentioned the protests taking place this weekend, the reports of Molotov cocktails, tear gas, water cannons. I understand you were present during some of these protests.
Yeah, I was at the protests on Saturday and Sunday, and it did kick off on Saturday, and you got a sense things were going to get violent, and they were going to get violent quickly. On Saturday, protesters built a roadblock around a Hong Kong police station. The police quickly came out, assessed the situation. They did retreat for a few minutes, but not long. After about 10 minutes, the police came back out of the police station with many more, at least 200 riot police in full riot gear. They held up a sign that said, "Police will take action." And within minutes, action they did take. They stormed the thousands of protesters that had blocked the road at a pace that I had never seen before at any of these protests. It was complete chaos for a period of time, knocking over journalists, knocking over nearly anyone in their way. And then, of course, there was the tear gas. The tear gas came, and it came fast. There were rounds and rounds on Saturday. Sunday, things went from chaos to complete mayhem in Kowloon. There was a typhoon passing through, heavy rains, but that didn't stop thousands of protesters taking to the streets. Many of them were the so-called frontline protesters, the ones that show up in yellow hard hats, complete protective gear. And when they show up, you know they are looking for a fight, and that's what they got. Police fired nearly 150 rounds of tear gas. That's not including the rubber bullets. They fired dozens of those. They also brought out the water cannon trucks to help clear the streets. It was a very chaotic scene, lots of running, lots of loud screaming, banging of metal poles up against makeshift shield. It was one of the more chaotic scenes I've seen in the 12 weekends of protests here in Hong Kong.
Has Carrie Lam indicated that she's willing to talk with any of the protesters as yet?
Carrie Lam has said she's willing to have dialogue, but that dialogue has been a bit confusing to understand. Nobody has really seen that happen yet, and the protesters are often quick to say, yes, she wants to have dialogue, but that's just a public relations, that's just PR for her.
So they don't really buy into it, that it's an earnest effort to have meaningful dialogue in their eyes.
Yeah, they don't feel that she's being earnest with them at all. And that's why they still continue after 12 weeks to take to the streets here. And even though we saw 10 to 12 days of relative calmness on the streets of Hong Kong, the violence clearly is built up and is going to continue to come out of these protesters.
Justin Solomon reports out of Hong Kong. Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
North Korea launched more ballistic missiles over the weekend. U.S. President Donald Trump, while at the G7 summit, said those tests don't violate any agreements in place. But?
Well, they violate U.N. Security Council resolutions, which is obviously a really big deal because essentially what Kim is doing is breaking international law. I think what Trump is trying to do is to sort of downplay these short-range missile tests. I think he's trying to give diplomacy every opportunity that it possibly can. The challenge is this. There's two factors that are going to impact the U.S.-North Korea relationship. The first, which I think we're all forgetting about, is the U.S.-China trade war. Think about it this way. With 90% of North Korea's exports going through Beijing, Beijing has the opportunity to break the maximum pressure campaign anytime it wants. So don't think for a second that the Chinese aren't going to use North Korea as essentially a bargaining chip in their negotiations. That means Kim will probably test more missiles because I think the Chinese will let him off the leash a little bit. I don't think he's going to go to ICBMs or nuclear weapons tests, but I think that is definitely, you know, short-range missiles are definitely going to be something that he is going to want to do. The other thing is the U.S. presidential election. For Kim Jong-un, put yourself in his position. Is he really going to want to ink a deal with Donald Trump, use some of that political capital, which he does have to use in North Korea, even though he's a dictator, and then know maybe a Democrat comes into office and scuttles the deal? So we have some very long-term problems in this U.S.-North Korea relationship that are not going to be easy to solve.
So where do you see talks going forward? Because North Korea has pretty much indicated that as long as the sanctions are in place, that talks really aren't going to move forward. And that is quite contradictory to what Mr. Trump is saying, that, you know, he's looking forward to having further discussions. President Moon Jae-in in South Korea is optimistic as well. But what is the likelihood that there will be another summit between Kim and Mr. Trump and, you know, even working level talks?
I think this only goes as far as the U.S.-China trade relationship goes. If there is some sort of short-term deal or even interim deal, maybe Kim will talk. That I think that is possible. But I think, if you are in Kim Jong-un's position, you look at the strategic landscape and say to myself, my God, the Chinese are already starting to loosen sanctions. The economy seems to be doing okay, not at a depression level, but maybe puttering along at maybe zero growth or maybe just starting to come out of the doldrums. If I can do that and I can keep my nuclear weapons, not a bad trade-off. It isn't a bad deal for Kim. But I think if the trade negotiations start going better, there is some sort of truce, maybe for Trump until the election, North Korea might be willing to come to the table. But I don't expect any major deals, unfortunately, at this point until after the election. It's just too risky for Kim.
When it comes to North Korea, there was also that joint intelligence sharing deal between Seoul and Tokyo, which South Korea scrapped last week. What does this mean for regional security now that the intelligence sharing agreement that was designed to help Seoul and Tokyo talk about North Korea is no longer there?
What is happening now, when you look at all of these different tensions throughout East Asia, you have multiple different essential powder kegs that could go off any minute. The U.S.-China trade relationship, South China Sea, Taiwan, East China Sea, North Korea, and now you put this on top of all of those different problems. I think it really, really makes the United States have to get much more involved in this specific situation between Japan and South Korea. You cannot have two allies at loggerheads like this.
And that was Harry Kazianis, Director of Korean Studies at the Center for the National Interest. And this is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute. Astronomers who have been reviewing observation data from the Kepler spacecraft have occasionally been treated to pyrotechnic displays they call superflares. These superflares are incredibly powerful bursts of high-energy radiation that are being blasted from relatively young and active stars. Scientists say superflares are hundreds to thousands of times more powerful than the largest recorded flares from our own sun. A team of astronomers say they have found evidence that suggests stars as old as our 4.6 billion-year-old sun can produce superflares once every few thousand years. They said if the sun should produce a superflare, Earth would be bathed in a blast of high-energy radiation. This could disrupt various electronic devices around the world, cause widespread power blackouts, and take orbiting communication satellites out of commission. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller. Israel says it has struck Iranian military sites in Syria to prevent what it said was a pending drone strike by Iran. Separately, reports from Lebanon say two Israeli drones came down in Lebanon. Some reports also say that Israel was behind an airstrike in July on an arms depot in Iraq. VOA's Lettice Ahok reports.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said Sunday that any country that allows its territory to be used for aggression against Israel will face the consequences. Netanyahu spoke during a visit to the Golan Heights, hours after Israeli forces attacked what they described as Iranian bases near the Syrian capital, Damascus.
If someone rises up to kill you, kill him first. In a complicated operation by the security establishment, we learned that Iran's Quds Force dispatched a special unit of Shiite militants in Syria in order to kill Israelis on the Golan Heights with killer drones. I would like to emphasize this was an initiative of Iran, under the command of Iran, at the behest of Iran.
The Israeli army has distributed surveillance footage filmed on August 22nd, which it says is showing Iranian Quds Forces members walking near the Syrian village of Arne near Damascus with a killer drone. Iran has denied that any of its posts in Syria were hit. The Syrian government says it has intercepted Israeli missiles before they reached their targets. The British-based war monitoring group Syrian Observatory for Human Rights said an Iranian fighter and two members of the Lebanese terror group Hezbollah were among the fatalities in the strike. Meanwhile, Lebanon has accused Israel of an attack on Lebanese sovereignty following reports that two Israeli drones crashed in Beirut late Saturday. The first drone reportedly fell on the roof of the Hezbollah media office in Beirut, and the other exploded in the air and fell on an empty plot nearby. In a rare televised comment on Sunday, Hezbollah chief Hassan Nasrallah said his forces will not tolerate any further intrusions from Israel.
If we remain silent on this breach, it will create a very dangerous road for Lebanon, where every two or three days an explosive drone or suicide drone will target a certain building, farm, field, mosque, compound, and no one knows from where it comes, repeating of what is going on in Iraq now.
A U.S. official confirmed Friday that Israel had struck an arms depot in Iraq belonging to a Shiite militia with links to Iran. Two Iranian commanders were reported killed in the July attack north of Baghdad. Israel's government has not acknowledged the attack in Iraq or links to the downed drones in Beirut. But Israeli forces have attacked Hezbollah's bases in Lebanon in the past. The United States has accused Iran of supporting Hezbollah and other terrorist groups in the region. Zlatica Ahok, VOA News, Washington.
In a call with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu about Israel airstrikes in Syria, the U.S. State Department said that Secretary of State Mike Pompeo expressed Washington's support for Israel's right to defend itself from the threat posed by Iran's Revolutionary Guard. And taking a quick look back in time, it was on this day in 1910 that Thomas Edison demonstrated for reporters an improved version of his kinetophone, a device for showing a movie with synchronized sound. And with that, that's going to do it for us today. You've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of producer Jackson Mungave, engineer John Dryden, and our managing editor, Kate Pound-Dawson, thank you so much for listening. You'll find in-depth news coverage of world events at the VOA News website. And don't forget, with our mobile app, you can Take the stories with you. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Have a great day.